Good morning. Welcome to the session. There's a couple of empty seats spread farther up here. If some of you would like to come forward. How many of you have not read Ball 4? Okay. Three. Well, you should. It's very funny. And it's very good on the kind of tenuous nature of a major league ball player's career. And, of course, it's a chronicle of what happens in the clubhouse, on the plains, in the field for an expansion team, which performs pretty much like you'd expect an expansion team to perform. What he doesn't tell you is the story of what went on in the front offices of the organization and the American League, which in a lot of ways was more incompetent than the 1969 Seattle Pilots. Let's start with the reasons, okay? In 1958, the Dodgers and the Giants moved to the West Coast. Immediately, a huge gap arises in attendance between the two leagues, almost completely because of the Dodgers and the Giants. The American League decides it has to respond. In the 1961 expansion, they create the Angels, which does some good, but not as much as they had hoped for. So they keep looking for ways to improve their picture on the West Coast, and eventually they turn to Charles Oscar Finley. Now, they weren't, they of course weren't very happy with Mr. Finley. They had dissuaded his attempts to go to Louisville, to go to Dallas, but all of a sudden when he comes forward proposing to go to Oakland, they're willing to listen to him, and he's allowed to move to Oakland. You can see the result. For the first 10 years, the Giants by themselves averaged $1.5 million. For the next 10 years, with the A's in town, the two teams together averaged $1.56 million, despite some very good A's teams in the early 1970s. The Bay Area at that point was just not capable of handling two teams. So that wasn't working out well for the American League either. And it also caused them other problems. Milwaukee had already sued unsuccessfully the National League for allowing the Braves to move from Milwaukee to Atlanta. But the American League knew it was going to be faced with trouble from Kansas City when they allowed Finley to move. So they pre-planned expansion, ignoring the National League, although that was a problem that was later solved. And so they're looking at expansion. They know one of those teams is going to have to go to Kansas City. So the question becomes, what is the other expansion city going to be? These are the possibilities that were talked about at the time. If you're going on the West Coast, the best possibility seems to be Seattle, especially since there are a couple of other cities within semi-reasonable distance that ought to help you with your attendance. Nobody's probably going to come for one game, but they might come for a weekend or a big series or something like that. That, of course, does leave the most attractive city on the list to the National League, which will once again increase its differential in attendance. This is what it's going to cost. The American League is going to charge you $100,000 just in cash, and then steal another $5.25 million by overcharging you for all these players, for a total of $5.35 million. Just to give you an idea of the relative health of the leagues at the time, the National League is going to charge its two new owners $4 million for a franchise fee and $6 million for the 30 great players it's selling, those wonderful teams. So they're getting nearly twice as much money for their expansion fees as the American League is. And this is just an estimate. I want to kind of staple this number of $7 million to your brain for comparison purposes as we get further into the presentation. But this is the kind of sporting news estimate of what it's going to cost to set up a new franchise, $7 million. So what do they do? In Kansas City, since everybody hated him, Finley, they'd had groups coming forward for a number of years to propose that they buy out Finley. So they had a roster of possible owners that were going through them and looking for them. They don't really have an idea of what's going to happen in Seattle, okay? This is Joe Cronin. Mr. Cronin is kind of, in my opinion, a perfect example of the Peter principle. He is an all-star shortstop. a decent manager, a rather poor general manager, and kind of a disaster as a league president. Now he's going to go to Seattle, and they don't have any real kind of business contacts in Seattle. So he goes to the guys they do know, the brothers Max and Dewey Soriano. Now both of these guys had been schoolboy sensation pitchers. Max had gone on and pitched at the University of Washington. Dewey pitched in the minor leagues, later moved up to be the general manager of the Seattle Rainiers and eventually the president of the Pacific Coast League, which is how they were known in baseball circles. So basically Cronin goes and in effect says to Dewey, do you want to put together a franchise? And Dewey says, oh, okay, we'll do that. Max can help me. He's my brother. And then they start looking around a bit. And the baseball people that they know best, person that they know best, is Gabe Paul. In 1964, the Indians had examined going to Seattle. And they had met Paul and through him, William Daly, who was a past part owner of the Indians, a majority owner of the Indians, actually. So eventually they go, they get in contact with Daly, and they wind up with an ownership structure that looks like this, okay? Which means, I mean, Daly owns more of the club than they do. More importantly, from the American point of view, I think, is to need to look at the pie like this. 60% of the money is coming from out of town. This should be a hint. It is not taken that way. It is not noticed that there is a lot of money in Seattle. The Boeing family, the Weyerhaeusers, the Nordstroms, these are all available, and they would prove instrumental in funding the National Football League team that would come to Seattle in just a few years. But, oops, as Max says, we don't need any help from outsiders, which is an interesting definition within a business community. He did that in response to a question from one of his executives who was looking to sell season tickets and sponsorships and advertising and all that kind of thing. And Dewey's response is, we don't need to talk to the downtown people. They're outsiders. So this is why you get the equity structure of the team that you do. At the time, it's perceived that the major problem in the city is the stadium. This is Sixth Stadium, PCL Park. When it was opened, it was considered one of the nicer parks in the PCL. But at this point, it's now over 30 years old. It has been owned by the city since 1965, and the city bought it because they thought they might put a freeway through there. And so they've been doing the kind of maintenance that you'd expect with that in mind. Asia had done it no favors. This is owned by a city and a downtown establishment, I should say, that frankly is just not that interested in baseball. There are five people on the city council, including the mayor. Two of those people on the city council are totally uninterested. Sorry, beyond uninterested, they are not willing to spend any money by the city to help get the team into town. In general, they are not feeling any pressure from the populace in general to do much for it. The downtown establishment's big project is called Forward Thrust. It's one of it is this rapid transit system that they're trying to push. There's business development and parks and recreation and community centers, a whole bunch, 13 different proposals within Forward Thrust. And this is voted on in February of 1960, about 3 months after the franchise had been approved for Seattle. Six of the notions passed, seven of them failed. One of them that did pass was for a new stadium in the city. So this, now that they're supposedly going to fix the stadium, this is what it looks like. The American League says we need a capacity of 30,000, all right? But hey, we'll settle for 28. And in reality, it only gets up to 23,420. That's the reported figure. I really wonder about that. The city says, well, we'll spend, you know, $1.175 million. The winning bid from the contractor to do the work that's being asked for comes in at $2 million. I should also say that the American League never specified exactly what it wanted. You know, it said, well, we want a bigger, better, major league quality stadium with 30,000 seats. Thank you very much. What that meant was not spelled out. There was no contract, no list of specifics, which you might guess led to problems. So they did expand the capacity. You can see there are a whole section of seats that's been added down the left field line, bleachers in both left and right. And in fact, they took one of their rather limited parking spaces to build the bleachers in right. But still, this is not really working. Capacity for opening day was theoretically 18,000, but the footings for the bleachers in right field have been built, but not the bleachers themselves. The bathrooms are not installed. They're using porta potties. They run out of beer in several sections of the park. The pilots go on a road trip, come back in May, and the patrons stand up and realize that the paint they had been sitting on had not quite dried. And then they get into one of these things that really typified. The pilots complain to the contractor, complain to the city. The city counters, or the contractor counters, that the pilots keep changing the requirements for the improvements in the stadium. And all of a sudden, there's this three-way bitching match between the owners and the contractor and the city. The city doesn't really want to pay, and this is all getting into the newspapers, okay? So essentially, the pilot's ownership keeps complaining, saying to their customers, please come out to our dump. And you get the predicted response. At the same time, this is the stadium that will eventually be built. But at this time we're talking about in 1969, what has happened is that after the referendum was passed, two different groups arose in the city arguing for different locations of the stadium. And this also is going back and forth in the stadium, in the city and in the newspapers, to the point where the people are being told that the existing stadium is a dump and that the future stadium may or may not come depending on where we decide to locate it. So the result is, again, somewhat inevitable. Opening day, they get 15 for a stadium that could hold 18. The Soriano said they hoped for a million but would break even at 850. They wind up getting 677 and change. And in June, they go to their accounting department and are told it looks like they're going to lose 2.2 million. So as the season ends, the drama begins to unfold. Very quietly, they decide to sell the team to a group from Milwaukee. This is not widely publicized, but it gets out around the city. Certainly, these two guys are being pretty quiet about it because they don't want to jinx the deal, because they know that the American League is not real happy about this. The American League does not want another lawsuit, does not want to pull the team out of the city, and of course, that's the whole purpose of the Milwaukee bid. So local groups begin to step forward, hoping that they can use the leverage of the American League's desire to stay to get something organized. There's three leaders of the group. Two of them are these fellow. Fred Dance owns a chain of movie theaters and other entertainment venues. Dave Cohn owns a chain of restaurants. They're both very interested in getting Major League Baseball to the city. So the American League approves them, approves the Dance group, and then things go on. The Dance people are trying to raise the money to come at least close to the Milwaukee bid. And this is not going well. Among other things, and here's where I'm going to recall that 7 million figure to your mind. All of a sudden, it comes out that the Sorianos had borrowed $3.5 million to fund the operation. They had not told the American League. They had not told anybody else, but all of a sudden, Fred Dance and his group have to raise $3.5 million more than they thought they did. And their main method of raising money was to sell season tickets. So $3.5 million was a huge mountain to overcome. The American League sees that's happening and says, we're going to revoke our approval of you. At that point, the third guy in the ownership group, a friend named Edward Carlson, who was the president of a hotel chain based in Seattle. He'd later be the president of United Airlines. He decides he's going to put together a community ownership group, like the Green Bay Packers. And he puts that forward, and Kuhn kind of tries to support him, but Finley is the loudest voice in a whole group of owners who say, no, that's not the way we do business. We have, you know, an identifiable owner, and we have a strong for-profit motive. So the American League is not going to listen to Ed Carlson. So they reject community ownership, but they know they've got a problem. So the next day, they agree that what they will do is they will loan the Sorianos $650,000 to tide them through spring training and into the beginning of the season, when they'll presumably get enough revenue to keep going. Then, a couple days later, preemptively, the city of Seattle and the state of Washington sue the American League so that they won't move the team. And then things really get turned around when the Sorianos and Daly just decide the only way we're not going to lose a lot of money is to take the case into bankruptcy. Now, the bankruptcy referee has a very specific duty, okay? His duty is to ensure that the creditors are paid back as much of their money as possible. He has no duty to the city of Seattle. He has no duty to the owners. He has no duty to the American League, only to the creditors. And therefore, he has to take the best offer, which, as you can imagine, comes from the Milwaukee people. It's been out there the whole time. There was also an offer from Dallas, but it never seemed to get as far. I mean, the Milwaukee people really put the money on the table. So the next day, in the Milwaukee papers, or this is actually from Suburban Racine, you get the idea of what's going on in Milwaukee. And within 1 year, the American League has taken a promising market and shipped it halfway across the country, and won't come back to Seattle for 8 years, which is another saga of how they negotiated the difference between what Seattle, King County, and Washington wanted and what the American League wanted, which eventually resulted in the Mariners. That is it. Happy to take any questions anybody might have.
It's
basically Bud being Bud. He worked his butt off and made friends with everybody. Fitzgerald was the money guy. Fitzgerald was the guy who was extremely well established in the community there. But Bud kept working at it, kept putting himself forward and doing the work that needed to be done, and also coming up with the money to slowly buy out Fitzgerald. But I think in terms of the Milwaukee establishment, Fitzgerald was the big guy. But Bud was the one who was willing to do the work and keep putting him out there.
And there was Oscar Mayer was one, and there was a little ghost about Herb Cole who put some money into it at one point.
Yeah. Okay. Barry?
All right, that was an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
When listed the major corporations or business entities in Seattle, you left out two that I happen to know a little bit about
with regard
to the Pirates. You left out Microsoft.
Which didn't really exist in 19...
Microsoft was indifferent to baseball in Seattle.
Okay.
Because they were building a global enterprise and they just didn't care.
Barry, I'm sorry, did Microsoft exist in 1968?
Microsoft Corporation.
68?
No. Bill Gates.
Yes.
Was indifferent to baseball in Seattle.
Okay.
He was intent on building a global corporation. But the other one he left out was actually inimical to baseball in Seattle, and that was the University of Washington.
Ah.
They were one of the largest employers in the city, and they were concerned about their sports franchise facing competition for Major League Baseball. And I was teaching at the University of Washington at the time, and but I happen to know that the faculty senate rejected every attempt by the pilots to try and drum up trade within the university community.
All right. Thank you, Barry. Lee? Mark?
Very illuminating.
Thank you.
Andy, are those stories true?
No, I made them up. Come on, Lee.
thank you, Lou. there were no bullpens, and then the bullpen, the personnel, the pitchers, catchers had to sit in the stands.
I'm not. It doesn't surprise me, but I don't know for sure.
Oh, there were bullpens on the sideline, and there were bullpen bench.
Okay.
And also there was the Seventh Avenue flush, because you couldn't flush the toilets until the seventh inning.
Yeah. Yeah. They had a lot of problems with the plumbing. It's a rather low-lying area.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Just curious, you noted that there had been a lawsuit between by the city of Washington, the state of Washington, against the team right before the bankruptcy filing. Did that lawsuit go away as a result of the bankruptcy?
That whole legal situation got complicated. You had the city of Seattle, you had King County, and you had the state of Washington. And it went into court, and it basically dragged on because the city really wanted to keep the leverage on the American League and Major League Baseball to get a team back. And Major League Baseball, specifically the American League, wanted to make sure this time that when they went to Seattle, there was a viable ownership group and a stadium. So both sides kind of had an interest in dragging things out. And the suits changed, and there were depositions and refilings. It was, a kind of a typical legal mess, but that was the path for the next 7 years, really, until the Mariners were created. Okay. David.
Presentation, Andy. Was that Mr. Fitzgerald, the same one who's from the Philippine ship? Was he?
It was his father.
Oh, his father.
He's a junior. They were both in the insurance business and did a lot. Mark?
I read that it was a confluence of a lot of things were going on in Seattle, that the aircraft industry was in a downturn. When they were selected, it was in an upturn. But as we know in the defense industry and all that, we have downturns and upturns, and they were in a big downturn. Did that have an effect? The people weren't showing up, was that also part of the deal that it was a bad timing for the pilots?
Well, I think it undoubtedly had an effect. I mean, Boeing was the hugest, industrial employer in town, and the fact that a lot of people were out of work clearly made a difference. I don't know that that's something the American League could have calculated in advance, because when they first made the decision and when the vote was held, as you noted, things were going pretty good. Then as Vietnam starts to wind down and, Boeing starts to wind down, then that hit a little bit later, I think, than maybe could have been anticipated. But it undoubtedly had an effect on attendance. People just didn't have money.
It sounds like an airplane would have always made the bad decision anyway, though.
Given their track record, yes. Yeah, I think that's fair. David?
Yeah, that was a fascinating presentation.
Thank you.
I think you went through a lot of detail on how the pilots rose and fall so quickly. I'm just curious about what the impact of team's mediocre at best level of play was on such factors as attendance and its economic viability. And we're talking about the legendary Joe Schultz in charge here.
Yeah, well, he certainly knew how to pound a bud, but I think undoubtedly, their attendance problems. It's an expansion team. Everybody knows it's an expansion team. Everybody knows how expansion teams perform. I mean, I think if you're the ownership, you're kind of hoping that the novelty of the situation, the availability of Major League Baseball, will bring people out to the ballpark. But at the same time, people are going to know that it's not going to be a good quality team. They're going to know that in advance. So, yeah, it's going to have an effect. You know, people will say, I have a friend who was living up there at the time who said, who kept bugging his father to take him to a Pilots game. And his father would say, well, they're not very good now. We'll go see them next year. So, they think.
Let's thank Andy.
If anybody wants to talk again, I'll be out in the hallway. I'll be actually over in the book room signing the book.